Hi, welcome to this week's program. Well, it's good to be back on the air after Hurricane Irma, and it's good to see life slowly limping back to normal in South Florida. But it's also heart-wrenching to see the effects of Harvey and Maria in Houston and Puerto Rico. Today, I plan to talk about Irma's economic impact on Floridians and on the state as a whole. Now, as most of you know, Hurricane Irma made landfall on Florida's Cudjoe Key at about 9 a.m. Sunday, September 10th, and caused a fair amount of damage across Florida before moving on to Georgia, South Carolina, and southern parts of North Carolina and Tennessee. Clearly, Florida was the worst hit on mainland USA. Within the U.S., the Florida Keys suffered the most, with 1 in 4 buildings destroyed, 2 in 3 buildings significantly damaged, and 90% of all homes impacted in some form or another. We here in Boca Raton were lucky that the storm shifted course and moved west. The islands are Barbuda, St. Bartholomew, St. Martin, Anguilla, and the Virgin Islands really bore the brunt of Irma's fury as a Category 5 hurricane, with catastrophic damage and loss of life. You know, talking about Irma, luckily there was a silver lining for us, which was that the storm and the damage it caused was not as bad as meteorologists had initially projected. Irma had weakened to a Category 3 storm by the time it made second landfall on the southwest coast of Florida, and then further weakened to a Category 2 storm when it hit further north in Naples, Florida. Even so, it still delivered 100 miles per hour winds, caused storm surges that flooded streets and homes, downed a couple of high-rise construction cranes in Miami, damaged power lines and mobile phone towers across the state, and resulted in loss of power to about 5 million homes and businesses. Irma also disrupted internet access, caused water supply and sanitation problems, heavily damaged Florida's citrus and sugarcane crops, and closed most of Florida airports. As a matter of fact, at one point on Sunday afternoon, there were literally no flights over Florida's airspace. So let's talk about Irma's economic impact. Preliminary estimates suggest that Irma could cost anywhere from $50 to $190 billion, depending on who you talk to. And it could knock off about a half of 1% to 1% from the entire U.S. GDP growth in the third quarter. That's a massive price tag compared to past storms. But I know the U.S. will recover from this temporary dip in GDP growth because our economic fundamentals are strong. We've got good job growth, rising consumer spending trends, even, you know, well before Irma struck, a strengthening global economy, rising corporate profits, and healthy financial markets. So hopefully, this will be a blip on the big picture of America's economic growth. Now, within the state, Florida's tourism industry took a hit because tourists canceled trips ahead of the storm. Additionally, ratings from Moody's projects a 12% drop in citrus production and a 10% drop in sugarcane crop due to the storm damage. Moreover, much of the temporary housing that hosts seasonal farm workers was destroyed or damaged, so the state's $8 billion agricultural sector has taken quite a hit. And with competing demands for construction funds from schools and social programs and infrastructure projects, Florida's state budget will be severely stretched through 2020. Now, in my research on Irma's economic impact, I came across a list of the 10 costliest Atlantic hurricanes and noted that hurricane costs have risen steeply over the past two decades. For example, the economic damage from Hurricane Ivan in 2004 was about $14 billion. Hurricane Katrina in 2005, $62 billion. Irma, it's expected cost as much as $190 billion on the high end of estimates, even though it was only a Category 2 storm by the time it hit mainland Florida. Sandy was about $30 billion. Andrew was $17 billion, and that was very devastating for South Florida. Wilma was $25.5 billion. Those seem to me a lot worse than Irma, and so on and so forth. So we'll see where Irma comes in on the cost scale. So I did some digging and finding out that there are two main reasons behind the sharply rising economic costs of hurricanes. The first is supposedly, and in many quarters, arguably, climate change. Many meteorologists forecast that climate change will bring deadlier and more frequent storms and extreme weather events, of which Irma is only the beginning. Or at least so they say. We'll have to wait and see about that. The second reason Irma's economic impact is so high is that there's an unrelenting increase in Florida's population. Demographers estimate that Florida's population grew by 1,000 residents per day. That's 333,500 new Floridians added in 2016 alone. Now, that's more than the population of St. Louis, and it's like we're adding a small Midwestern city to our state every single year. And I guess it's the allure of lower taxes, the sunshine, the easy living, and it's going to continue to attract more and more people in the years to come. So as a result, our cities are getting jammed. The people who can't afford to live in cities are building homes and commercial structures in inland areas that are more susceptible to flooding and wind damage. So the next time a storm hits, there will simply be more people and more businesses that will be impacted, and the economic costs will continue to rise. A 2013 World Bank survey entitled "Which Coastal Cities Are at Highest Risk of Damaging Floods?" found that Miami was ranked number 2 and Tampa was ranked number 7 for flood damage from rising sea levels and storms. So as people flock to places like Miami and Tampa, these cities will build more high-rises, and stricter building codes will require that they build better defenses, such as dikes and seawalls, which is all well and good for peace of mind. But if those defenses fail, a lot more people will be impacted, so overall economic losses will be even more steep. And here's another thing to think about. If a Category 2 storm could cause so much damage, what would happen if we took a direct hit from a Category 5? Imagine the consequences. Now, storms, of course, have a big impact on the insurance industry, so expect to see premiums go up over the years for home insurance, car insurance, flood insurance, health insurance. But on a more personal level, less than 18% of Florida homeowners have flood insurance, so a lot of people will have to pay for repairs and damages from their own pockets. And that could lead to a fair amount of borrowing, adding to household debt burdens. Storm repair costs could also take a big bite out of discretionary consumer spending, with fewer trips to the malls and restaurants and local attractions. So that might hurt the retail economy. And additionally, people may not have enough money left over to add to their retirement savings and investments. So 2017 could see a downward blip on how much Floridians save and invest, resulting in a domino effect that will take a while to recover from. The storm is also expected to temporarily raise grocery, gas, and building material prices, increase in the price of items typically shipped in and out of Florida ports, and result in a construction backlog as people rush to recover from the storm. So with a limited supply of repairmen, your own recovery may be slower than you'd like. All right, I just want to add this. With all the economic havoc that Irma has caused to many people's finances, it's all the more critical that you get some good advice, maybe from your financial advisor or from a trusted, well-educated friend. So you know which investments to break if you need the money, which ones not to touch, which loans to take on and at what terms, how to make sure you continue to pay for vital expenses such as mortgages, tuition, and on and on. The bottom line is you want to simply make the right decisions at an important juncture like this. Mistakes made today can affect you and cast a financial shadow for many years to come. It's vital to not let panic and fear dominate your financial decisions. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Nicole Duran is a senior editor for Kiplinger, and she oversees government and political coverage. And I've asked her to join me today to discuss the details of the recent tax cut proposals, which have just been released. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So President Trump revealed the framework for his new tax plan. What can we expect?
Right. I would first caution that this is just a framework and a lot can change between what we have now and what might ultimately pass Congress. Mm-hmm. That being said, we have a very good idea of what the president and congressional Republicans want. Their main priorities are to whittle down the number of individual tax brackets to 3. They want to cut the top corporate tax rate. They want to eliminate things like the alternative minimum tax, mm-hmm. and do a number of other things that they say will stimulate the economy.
All right, well, let's get into that a little deeper now. So right now we have 7 existing tax brackets, and the proposal is to decrease that to just 3.
Right.
10%, 15%, and 35%. On the surface, that sounds like a good idea. Any problems with that?
Well, actually, it's 12%, 25%, and 35%. Right. So Democrats and critics would say the first problem with that is that you just took the lowest bracket from 10% to 12%.
Okay.
Now, the president and his advisors, Gary Cohn, was just briefing reporters yesterday at the White House, and he argues that they will raise how many people qualify for that lowest bracket, and that actually many people will pay no taxes, mm-hmm. more people than now. The only problem with that is we don't know, because they haven't actually given us the income brackets that they want to fill in those levels with. So, you know, you don't know what kind of income level they're talking about right now.
Right. So let me just get back to these numbers that I misspoke. The 3 brackets are what again?
12% would be the lowest, mm-hmm. and then 25% and 35%.
Okay, very good. So now we don't really know how much money you have to make or declare for you to be in the 12% bracket or the 25 or the 35% bracket. So that matters.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's,
okay.
Absolutely. Those details matter. That will either quell or increase criticism once they give us those details. And as far as the 35% bracket, again, Democrats and critics immediately panned that because that's lowering the tax rate.
Yeah. Okay, so there's more to it than that. But before we get on to that,
sure.
One very important feature of this is the doubling of the standard deduction. First of all, for those who don't know, what is the standard deduction?
The standard deduction is an amount that a filer can automatically take to reduce their taxable income if they don't itemize.
Okay.
And the majority of people do not itemize their taxes.
Right. So it's kind of the first tranche of money that you make that will not be taxed.
Right.
So it's the standard deduction. So the government is talking about doubling the standard deduction from about 12,700 to 24,000. So that's going to, I think, take a lot of people out of the 12% or eliminate them from the 12% bracket. What do you think about that?
Right, exactly. And again, we don't quite have all the numbers, but that is exactly what the president and his advisors are saying, that many, many more people won't have to pay any taxes, mm-hmm. you know, won't even get to that 12% because of these increases. So again, we won't know until we actually get the figures.
Now, there are other factors in here. You mentioned the alternative minimum tax, which a lot of retirees pay if they live in heavily taxed states like New York and New Jersey and the like. So that would be eliminated. But there's also really talk about eliminating the deduction for state taxes.
Yes.
Am I correct about that? So that's going to be a big thing. So maybe for
that is
the lowering of the tax bracket itself from 39.5 to 35 seems like a tax cut. If you eliminate the deduction for the state taxes, it may take some of that back.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yes. So that there is a lot of Republican representatives from states such as New York are deeply opposed to this and have been because they are very concerned that their constituents will automatically have to pay significantly more in taxes. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the ways the president and Republicans are proposing to pay for some of these tax cuts is by eliminating that deduction. But it cuts both ways. Some people say this only hurts quote-unquote blue states, you know, Democratic-leaning states, mm-hmm. but it affects any state, you know, where that allows you to do that. And of course, there are voters of all stripes in all states.
Yeah, I don't think that's political in and of itself. So also, you write that these tax cuts may mean big tax savings for many retirees. And you think it's an opportunity for retirees to start thinking about how to adjust to that. What would these tax savings be for retirees?
Well, as you said, many retirees are subject to the alternative minimum tax.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, by eliminating that, you've helped a lot. These would be your wealthier seniors, as you know, your lower income seniors, well, A, probably aren't paying taxes at all, and B, wouldn't be subject to it. But there's also the elimination of the estate tax. That's not what they pay, but their heirs.
Yeah.
So as far as how much money they can pass on. And then these pass-throughs, they're lowering the rate on what you call a pass-through.
Mm-hmm.
This is people who file S-corps and sole proprietorships and partnerships that get listed on their personal income taxes.
Yeah.
And so that would lower the rate to 25% from mm-hmm. 35%. So that is a huge savings there as well.
Right now, if you have a small business and you're an S corporation, any of the income flows down to your personal tax return. So if you're in a really big bracket, you're going to pay that high tax bracket on that. And this proposal is to limit that to 25%. So that's a big deal. I think also, if the tax brackets are reduced, you know, you mentioned 12, 25, and 35, money coming out of IRAs and other tax-deferred assets will come out and be taxed less. So that may help as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Again, assuming they don't change any of the rules, though, about IRAs and such.
Yeah. So we're going to have this discussion again in not too long, maybe another 60 days or so. We'll see how the tax cut proposal goes through Congress. What do you think the next step is here, Nicole?
Well, the next step is passing a budget resolution. So I don't want to get too in the weeds on you, but Republicans intend to pursue tax reform and tax cuts by using a parliamentary procedure called budget reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
And all that means is it allows them to pass spending bills in the Senate without fear of a filibuster.
Mm.
So basically with only Republican votes, and they have 52 seats in the Senate. So that means they don't really have to deal with the Democrats if they can use this procedure.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing they have to do is actually pass a budget resolution, because you have to have something to reconcile. And so you have to have this underlying resolution. It has to include instructions for tax cuts. So in fact, since we've been speaking, the Senate Budget Committee laid out the text of their proposed budget resolution. The House has already done that. The House committee has already passed it. In fact, the House will probably vote on theirs next week. And now it looks like the Senate will be ready to as well. So that's step one.
All right. Well, hold on. We're out of time. So let's just say that the battle begins. I think they're going to try to get this done before year end. We'll see what happens. My guess. My guess is Nicole Duran, senior editor of Kiplinger. Thank you so much for your information, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
To hear this interview again, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. This is a place where you can sign up for our weekly updates, listen to any segment you'd like in particular, or perhaps even read the segment as well. We have it all there for you, stevepomerantz.com. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. Dick Lehr is a professor of journalism at Boston University, as well as a reporter at the Boston Globe, where he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in investigative reporting. He was a longtime member of the newspaper's investigative reporting unit, the Spotlight Team, which was highlighted in the movie Black Mass about the Boston crime boss Whitey Bulger, and was made into a film starring Johnny Depp. And today we're going to talk about his novel, Trell, based on the story of a drive-by gang-related shooting death of 12-year-old Tiffany Moore in 1988, and the daughter of the wrongly accused convicted man who persuaded a reporter and a lawyer to help her prove her father's innocence. Dick Lehr, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So give us a brief synopsis of the story. Let's take it from there.
Sure. Well, this is a novel largely aimed at young adults, and the protagonist, the main character, is a 14-year-old girl from the Roxbury neighborhood in Boston who's grown up with her father, her daddy, in prison for a murder that occurred when she was a newborn baby girl. And she's marked time by going to the prison, visiting her dad, and always asking daddy, when you coming home? Well, the main action of the novel is she's 14 now, and all the legal appeals have been exhausted that they've worked with a lawyer. And the lawyer's thrown up her arms and hands and said, all I can think is if we can get a journalist, a reporter, to poke around into here and maybe uncover some new evidence, that's all I can think of. And so Trell, this young girl who's really determined to help her dad get home, figures out who the best reporter at the Boston Globe is. And she overcomes his initial resistance, I'm not interested in this and whatnot, and they partner up. And over the course of the main action of the plot, the two of them are a team, an investigative team, so to speak, and they work the streets of Boston trying to develop the evidence to show that her father was wrongfully convicted in a murder.
So this is a novel and based on a true story, so kind of break down the difference between the two here.
Yeah, well, I call it my scaffolding. Years ago, one of my last stories I did for the Globe was to investigate a wrongful conviction case involving a man who was in prison for a murder. You know, obviously, he didn't commit as a result of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And he did when he was first arrested in the late 80s. He had a newborn baby girl, and it was a notorious case in Boston at the time. I used that as scaffolding, as infrastructure to take off and to develop the story around this girl, Trell, who's, you know, a young teenager. So it's largely fictionalized, but it's inspired by this true case that mm-hmm. I had worked on when I was a reporter at the Boston Globe.
Now, when you were writing that story and when you were at the Boston Globe, the family was poor, urban,
yep.
couldn't
yep.
afford a high-priced lawyer.
Yep.
And, you know, so this is a show about money. This is a show about economics. You know, to what degree did the economic system prevent these families from kind of getting fair trials?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things about this, you know, to me, it's a realistic, you know, novel, drama, reality-based kind of thing. And one of the things between the lines is that you do have this family that's struggling in the city. They don't have the resources to hire a high-powered, high-priced, fancy law firm to defend, you know, his name is Romero Taylor, when he's first arrested and picked up off the streets. When he's convicted originally, you know, in the backstory of the novel, his lawyer, you know, was a drunk. You know, he was just a public defender who was, you know, useless to him.
Yeah.
So it kind of captures the systemic inequalities and the economics that can come into play in the court system. Fast forward to, you know, when their trial is working on the case, again, they still can't hire a big-time lawyer, but they do have a lawyer, someone fresh out of law school, who's a bulldog. And, you know, they got lucky that way.
Mm-hmm.
It was her first appellate case and whatnot, but, you know, she's doing her best, but she's a rookie.
Now, in this book, the protagonist, Trell, is determined to better herself and to break out of the Boston school system and the, I guess, the cycle of poverty and despair. And
mm-hmm.
so how do you characterize that?
Yeah, what I do, and that's part of developing her traits, And she's also a runner, a long-distance runner. I mean, all these things are the theme of a marathon. Trying to prove her father's innocence is a marathon, you know, investigative journalism. And also that she's determined to do better and to get ahead. Well, on her own, she got herself into an exclusive private school outside of Boston. And her family's really proud of her that she, you know, showed that kind of gumption and initiative. Again, one of the secondary storylines is that her first year there, she hated it. She was the proverbial fish out of water. She didn't know what to say to people. You know, classmates are talking about their parents going to Yale and Harvard, and she'd turn around and go the other way because if someone asked her, her dad's in prison in Walpole, maximum security prison.
Right.
So she's really struggling with that kind of economic disparity. And then even the kind of token, you know, progressive liberalism of some of the teachers who are making assumptions about, you know, she's late to school and assuming that there's all these kind of wild parties going on at her home. And so it shows someone struggling with those kinds of disparities and whatnot.
She's mingling with people who live in mansions and have drivers.
Chauffeur-driven cars.
And there's no doubt that she must have felt totally, you know, not accepted or kind of worthy in that situation. I mean, what would keep a person like that focused on the long term, especially at that age?
Well, one of her main decisions while she's working with the reporter that summer on her dad's case is she doesn't want to go back. And she's got to make up her mind whether to go back because she did feel so defeated by it. But there was one lifeline. There was, in the English class, an English teacher started to get through to her with some poetry and whatnot. So there is a little ray of hope there. But that's one of the, you know, the decisions that's pending that she's struggling with and whether or not to go back. And the reporter, the relationship that she develops with this older reporter from the Boston Globe, his experience, he had apparently, you know, I mean, he went to private school in his back story and he got thrown out. So he starts to, they talk a little bit about that and how it can be a good thing. You can make it work for you. You know, so those are the kinds of dialogues they have.
You know, it's interesting how one person or one or two people in a young person's life can really make all the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've experienced myself on that. So you worked with the Spotlight team, which, as I mentioned in the intro, was characterized or highlighted in that film starring Johnny Depp about Whitey Bulger. What was it like to work there?
Oh, it was something I always aspired to. I grew up in Connecticut, and the Globe was, you know, my dream place to work as a journalist. And at the Hartford Current, I had gotten into investigative reporting, so the Spotlight team was, you know, where the action is. It's a real luxury and a public service to be part of a unit that doesn't have a daily deadline.
Yeah.
The mission is to go deep and go wide, and let's uncover and develop things that our readership, our audience, ought to know about in terms of perhaps corruption or systemic failure. And, you know, it's a long-standing, you know, it's an institution at the Globe, and despite the struggles of newspapers everywhere, the Globe has kept its commitment to the Spotlight team.
Well, you know, we're going through a period of time in our own history where the quality of news is questioned. You know, we've heard this term fake news all the time. Actually, I'm going to be doing a commentary on fake economic news, how to tell the difference between the two. What are your thoughts these days about the quality of journalism, and how do we protect ourselves as lay readers? How do we know the difference?
Well, I mean, the quality is all over the map. I think the key is, and, you know, I teach journalism now at BU, and I think it's almost like everyone has to develop, in some ways, their own journalism muscle in order to approach everything that's coming at us. And as we consume information, some of it accurate, a lot of it not, that we be skeptical and be trained, as journalists are trained, is to test information, you know, not believe everything we see or hear, but developed strategies to go sideways and to verify. And it may sound exciting, it may feed into something I want to believe, but hold on, there's just so much chaos out there.
Well, you know, I know how to go to the gym and develop a muscle. I know how to do that, and but I don't know how to develop a journalism muscle.
Yeah,
I mean, I can see if you're in the business, you know, you can double check and all that. Anything come to mind as some quick clues as to what you can do?
I know that there are engineers trying to develop apps that would help consumers.
Yeah.
People have talked to me about that. And I certainly have read about educators trying to find ways to embed early on in elementary and middle school years into the curriculum this ability to test and be the skepticism. I mean, I think that's all good. It's not going to happen overnight. and I think we've missed a lot of folks, but I think, you know, there's some hope there. To loop it back to Trell for a second, I mean, one of the things I think it makes it timely, too, is that Trell and teams up with a journalist, and this whole investigation and everything that they do to try to prove her father's innocence is about journalism. And one of my big messages or takeaways, hopefully for a younger audience, is the role of journalism, is the power of journalism in our world, in our democracy. That's something that's near and dear to my heart. Yeah. So that's a big part of Trell.
Definitely don't want to take that for granted. Unfortunately, Dick, we are out of time. You know, to hear this interview again or to listen to the full show or to get a summary of the vital lessons learned here today, go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update and we'll send you important lessons from the show straight to your inbox on a weekly basis, telling you what's going on, what we've talked about, and something that I think you'll benefit from. Dick Lehr, thank you very much for joining us. It was a great help.
You're welcome, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Hey, we've got a lot going on here because we've had a couple of storms. Maybe you heard about them.
Or lived through them.
Harvey and Irma, and we were looking at Maria, but it looks like we're going to miss that bullet. I was just wondering for a while why it seemed like the women hurricanes were being, you know, the
you
worst.
Know,
but then I forgot about
Harvey. This, yeah, well, you forgot about Andrew, too. But
Andrew.
I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah, Wilma, Katrina.
It's the names. I mean, why are they old names? Irma, Wilma.
Yeah. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. All right, so tell us about home sales, existing home sales. What's going on in your marketplace?
Well, in our marketplace, you know what, we did just go through a hurricane. And interestingly enough, you know, right after the storm, the phone started ringing again. And it's not that they're afraid that they want to move from the storm. The calls that I've been getting are people are just moving up their timetable. Mm. A lot of them are people that I've already met in recent months, and they've just decided now's the time. So I don't know if it really had anything to do with the storm, but there seems to be, you know, quite a bit of phone calls, people inquiring about what their homes are worth.
Yeah.
Thinking about selling, but I don't really relate the two directly to one another.
Well, in other hurricanes, like Andrew especially, where South Florida was really just kind of just destroyed almost in certain areas, there was a lot of people that just moved north to northern counties, northern parts of our state. They just wanted out, which created a lot of new business, a lot of new construction, a lot of new homes for sale. You think that Irma, the degree, the category that hit us here in South Florida, do you think Irma is going to have that same effect?
I don't think so. I was actually hoping or was anticipating that there would be a big push for rentals, you know, if homes were damaged and people had to get out from mold or what have you for short term.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I haven't even seen the phones ringing for that type of situation. So basically what I see is, you know, we lost a lot of trees, a lot of power outages.
Yeah.
But really, I'm not even aware of any home damage with the clients that I'm speaking to.
With Wilma, we saw lots of blue tarps on the roofs here.
That's right.
Which indicated the roof damage and it was protection from the leaks. We've seen nothing like that.
That's right. And I also think things have changed too. You know, you have to go through a 4-point inspection. And part of that 4-point inspection is you have to have 3 out of 5 years of useful life remaining on your roof in order to get insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think since Wilma, that's really, you know, paid off. I think, you know, the roofs are more solid. I think the insurance companies want to see that if you are getting a new house or, you know, purchasing a resale, that the roof is solid. And I think that's some of the, you know, good things that have come out of, you know, the Wilma, which was back in 2005, you know, compared to Irma today.
Yeah, well, there have been significantly higher building standards. And you and I were discussing earlier, we read in one report where these homes are being built to withstand 170 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that's going to have an effect. You know, I don't know what the insurance companies are going to do, but we could use new construction. I mean, that would be great if we all had homes that withstood 170 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, that's really catastrophic.
Have you had to go through any re-inspections? You know, people selling their houses and everything has been inspected and then the hurricane hits and now they haven't yet closed, so they have to have it re-inspected. What's going on there?
Yes. If the home's already been appraised and you're waiting for closing, there's that, you know, window of time. And I have one particular house. It just got re-inspected yesterday. And the re-inspection is pretty light in this particular case. They just do, you know, walk around the exterior. They don't do complete re-inspections. If I were to be buying a house during this window of time, especially if it's an older roof, I would certainly get my inspector back out to check the roof. Because in this particular case, the owner confessed that she developed a roof leak. You know, the seller's taking care of it. But, you know, she could have been very dishonest about it, not told us. And if the buyer didn't do his due diligence and have it re-inspected, then he would be buying a house and soon discover that he has a new roof leak.
I have a neighbor who sold their house and was in that exact situation. And she told me that her attorney said that if there was any difference, if there was any negative change, let's say, between the initial inspection and this re-inspection, that they could cancel the contract.
Well, yes, but there's clauses, and I'm not going to give you the exact amounts, but I think it's like if the amount is greater than 1%, either party can cancel. There are provisions in the contracts. But, you know, generally, you know, even with Wilma, I didn't have any deals fall apart. Mm-hmm. They just work through them. The seller can give a certain amount. I think it's 1.5%. They can give a credit for those repairs.
Right.
And then if it exceeds a certain amount, either party can cancel or come to a mutual agreement. You can postpone the closing. There's different things that you can do. But absolutely, if you've gone through a storm, since we've gone through this storm, if you are purchasing a house and you've already had it inspected, definitely go ahead and have it re-inspected, especially the roofs.
Okay, we've been talking about South Florida, but what about the rest of the country? What's the state of home sales in the rest of the country? Have home sales been going up? Have they been going down? What's going on?
Well, based on the August report, sales fell about 1.7%. That's a national look at things, but that also factors in Hurricane Harvey and Irma. Now, part of the reason also that the sales are down is the basic fact that there's very little inventory all across the nation. And when you have low levels of inventory that you don't have much to sell, you can't have an increase in sales.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to be buying, there's got to be houses for sale.
You got to have inventory.
I know. And you know, you're talking about bricks and mortar. So it's not something, it's not like a company that can just issue more shares of stock or something.
That's right.
You've actually got to go out and build something.
Got to build houses. And that brings us to another problem. The new inventory of new homes is really down.
Yeah, I don't understand. I really don't understand why builders aren't incredibly capitalizing on this shortage. But you know, Terry, we are out of time. So we're going to get to this in another time. Of course, my guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Taking a break from all things financial, I came across a new book highlighting moments of our country's past, which changed our world, but are still largely unknown today. These are about people who accomplished great things, but whose stories are buried until a talented writer can bring them to us. Jason Fagone is one such writer. He's been named one of the 10 young writers on the rise by the Columbia Journalism Review. He writes for the Huffington Post, Highline, GQ, Esquire, New York Times, and many more publications. He lives in Philadelphia, where he joins me today. Hey, Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve. Thank you for having me.
So perhaps joining the ranks of Hidden Figures, which is the recent movie about the Afro-American women who worked for NASA in the 60s, and The Imitation Game, the story of codebreaker Alan Turing, you've written The Woman Who Smashed Codes, the true story of love, spies, and the unlikely heroine who outwitted America's enemies. So who was this woman? And start us off. Tell us about her story.
Yeah, it's an amazing American story, and it was hidden or suppressed for a long time, which is one reason I wrote the book. I think people should know this. So Elizabeth Smith Friedman is one of the most brilliant Americans no one's ever heard of. She was a code breaker, someone who solved secret messages without knowing the key. And she used that ability to do a couple of things of major importance that altered the shape of the 20th century. So one thing she did was she helped invent the modern science of code breaking that still drives our intelligence agencies. She also hunted Nazis during World War II. Particularly, she hunted Nazi spies. And all that time, she was the partner and inspiration to the guy who's considered to be the godfather of the National Security Agency, a guy named William Friedman.
She was a woman of some courage, you know, demanding, based on her background, that she go to college. We're talking about the early 20th century. She didn't really start out code breaking. She's got an interesting story about how she started out. And it reminds me of, you know, people's lives when you ask them how they ended up where they did. And they said, well, I started doing something completely different. How did she start out?
Yeah, that was exactly her story. She always called it pure accident. She never set out to be this. It was just fate. So she was not a mathematician, not a trained mathematician at all. Instead, she was a poet, a literature expert. She studied poetry in college and the works of William Shakespeare. And when she graduated in 1915, she was 23 years old, and her career options at that point, career options for American women, were extremely limited. You know, any woman who had a college education and any kind of scholarly ability was, you know, able to teach grade school or high school, but not much more than that. And so Elizabeth got a job teaching at a high school, but she really wanted something more adventurous. And so she took a risk, and kind of a number of chance encounters launched her on this life of adventure.
You know, back then in 1915, when she graduated from college, almost 90% of professors at public universities were male, and only 62 women earned PhDs in all of America. So the chances of her doing something unique were pretty limited. I would think that she had to be, as I said, pretty courageous to go out there in the world and try to find somebody. But you know what? This story is even more interesting because she had this chance encounter with this eccentric textile tycoon, George Fabian. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So one day in June 1916, Elizabeth, she's 23 years old. She has just quit her job as a school teacher. She has decided to go to Chicago. As you said, very brave. She's not a city girl. She grew up in rural Indiana. She's going to go to the big city and try to find a different kind of job, something more adventurous, something more unusual. And during a trip to a library in Chicago, she happened to run into an eccentric multimillionaire who had made a fortune in the Chicago textile industry. His name was George Fabian. And Fabian was a very colorful multimillionaire of the Gilded Age. He was like a William Randolph Hearst or an Andrew Carnegie. He was this giant guy, 6'4", 240 pounds, big iron gray beard, extremely forceful, kind of, you know, gusts of wind would emerge from his face when he spoke. And he met this petite 23-year-old woman, Elizabeth Smith, at this library, and he became fascinated with Elizabeth because in talking to her, he realized that she knew about Shakespeare. And George Fabian was interested in Shakespeare, in fact, obsessed with Shakespeare, because he had this kind of deviant theory that Shakespeare wasn't really Shakespeare, that the plays of William Shakespeare had actually been written by a guy named Francis Bacon. And moreover, Fabian believed that there was proof of this that was hidden inside the works of Shakespeare in the form of secret messages. So that's how Elizabeth got started. She was hired by this guy, Fabian, this multimillionaire, to find messages in Shakespeare.
Yeah, so that's in a sense, code-breaking. So that's the very beginning of it. She was working with a woman who was actually looking, you know, kind of between the lines and looking for these kind of code words that Francis Bacon would have put in there to indicate that he was, in fact, the writer. So how did she get from there to actual code breaking?
Accident. Accident of fate and accident of history. So she went to work for George Fabian. She was working with a team of experts, literature experts, that Fabian had assembled from all over the world to go on this quest of trying to find these secret messages in Shakespeare. And it turned out that the messages weren't really there. They were kind of an illusion. The people who thought they saw them were just kind of seeing something that they wanted to be there. But in the course of trying to find these false messages, Elizabeth became interested in how you might actually find true messages. And then a year after she got started, 1917, America suddenly went to war. We went to war in the First World War. And what that did is it created an immediate, urgent need for American code breakers to help in the war. And the fact was, in 1917, there really were no American code breakers. There was no NSA, there was no CIA, and the FBI was very young. So essentially, the military looked around and said, we don't have any code breakers. We need code breakers immediately. The only people in America who know anything about code breaking are these kind of odd group of Shakespeare people out in the middle of Illinois working for this crazy rich guy. So that's actually where the NSA began. That's the seed of the NSA, is that team of Shakespeare experts out in the middle of Illinois working for this crazy rich guy. As strange as that sounds, I mean, truth is stranger than fiction sometimes. That's how the NSA got started.
It's very interesting in your book because you also give examples, actually numerous kind of simple examples of how code breaking works and cryptology and how you kind of transfer one set of figures, words, letters into others and some of the science behind that. But she didn't only work to decode wartime messages. She was working with the FBI as well to decode criminal activity. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So after World War I, she and her husband, William Friedman, left Riverbank. They left the employ of this crazy rich guy, moved to Washington, D.C., and Elizabeth began working for the United States Treasury Department, which needed somebody to break codes that were sent by rum runners, liquor smugglers. Mm-hmm. So during Prohibition, all of these criminal gangs had risen up, and Elizabeth spent 10 years decoding the secret messages of rum runners. And what that did is that it made her extremely experienced and talented at the art and the science of radio intelligence. So she learned how, in a systematic way, to use intercepted radio messages, break the code, solve the messages, map the secret networks of the people who are using these shortwave radio sets and these codes, and throw light on an underworld that was trying to stay hidden. You know, she did that during Prohibition with rum runners, and it turned out that on the eve of World War II, that was an extremely important skill set, because after Hitler invaded Poland, a number of Nazi spies began spreading out into the Western Hemisphere, and it turned out that when they were going into the Western Hemisphere, they were carrying radio sets that were very much like the radios used by the rum runners. And so suddenly, Elizabeth had this unique skill set, and she started to work on a new phase of her career, which was she hunted Nazis. She hunted Nazi spies, and she used the same techniques that she had perfected during the Prohibition period to throw light on these dark networks of Nazi spies and ultimately disrupt them and neutralize the threat.
Yeah, I want to get into that in more detail in a minute. The book is The Woman Who Smashed Codes, The True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. My guest is Jason Fagoni, the author. She was involved in some famous Prohibition cases. You mentioned rum runners. Actually, even to the point where Joseph P. Kennedy, the father of John F. Kennedy, was part owner of one of these companies that she was looking at. But she was a very private person, and she was put out into the public spotlight at one time during a trial. I thought that was a really great part of the story. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some aspects of her career were in fact hidden and secretive, but some aspects were exorbitantly public. She became briefly famous during the 1930s for her work battling these
liquor and smuggling rings. And what happened was, as you mentioned, Joseph P. Kennedy, the father of the future president of the United States, JFK, was an investor in a Canadian rum syndicate called the Consolidated Exporters Corporation. And the Consolidated Exporters Corporation was an intentionally boring name given to this syndicate by the Canadians to hide its spectacular nature. It was essentially a global navy of pirate ships. And there were at least 60 of these ships. Some of them were as big as a warehouse, like floating warehouses that could hold about 80,000 crates of liquor. And they spanned the entire globe, and they used codes to protect their communications that were stronger and more sophisticated than even codes that had been used in World War I. So one of the things that Elizabeth did during this period was she became a nemesis of this Consolidated Exporters Corporation. She tracked its ships all around the globe. She learned the names of the ships, the names of the captains, sometimes even the names of the crewmen. She read their thoughts, essentially, by intercepting and decrypting their radio messages, and then she would hand these radio messages to law enforcement, and law enforcement would ask her to appear at the trial.
Yeah.
When they were trying to convict these guys, they needed Elizabeth to come in and explain the science of code breaking to a jury. And so Elizabeth would come in with her handbag and her pink dress and her pink hat with a flower pinned to the brim.
Mm-hmm.
And she would sit on the witness stand and stare out at some of the most fearsome gangsters of her day.
Yeah, at one point, I think she was guarded by some gun-toting federal marshals as well. So she was a brave woman. You know, she also worked with the FBI. And J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI at that time. And basically, they knew nothing. The FBI didn't really know much about how to break codes and how to do counterintelligence. And basically, she did all the work and he got all the credit. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, that was another aspect of a pattern that repeated throughout Elizabeth's career. She was always ending up someplace sort of trying to patch a gap in the understanding or ability of some agency that was caught unprepared by a new challenge. And so that was J. Edgar Hoover, and that was the FBI at the start of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the FBI's responsibility, its job, was to catch Nazi spies anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. That was their jurisdiction. And yet, the FBI had no real ability to do that because they didn't know how to break codes. They had no code-breaking organization. They had no code-breaking experience. So they were forced to rely on Elizabeth Friedman and her team of codebreakers at the U.S. Coast Guard, that she had created that team and nurtured it and trained it. And they were very good because they'd done all this rum work. And so J. Edgar Hoover relied on Elizabeth and her team to break the codes of these Nazi spies, to monitor the radio circuits. And Elizabeth monitored about 50 different radio circuits for the FBI and other agencies, fed the solved messages to the FBI, allowed the FBI agents to know all of the details of these Nazi spy networks, their names, their locations, even down to the amounts of money that they were spending on their spy equipment.
Mm.
Elizabeth knew all of these things because she could read their thoughts and provided this stuff to the FBI. Then the FBI would go in and make the arrest and take all the credit.
Well, you know, today the NSA and the FBI and the CIA are ubiquitous. They're part of the daily fabric of the world. I mean, we're dealing with a Russian investigation right now, which requires the U.S. to perform counterintelligence, to kind of work backwards. I don't know what they do or how they do it, but to figure out who's doing what to whom. You know, there's a quote that starts part two of your book that really caught my attention, and here it is. To work in this field, you have to become devious yourself. You have to think like a malicious attacker to find the weaknesses in your own work. Now, this was written in 1910. Jason, has anything changed today?
Well, I think that may be a more modern or contemporary quote about cryptography and cryptography engineering, but the principle is absolutely true and timeless. I mean, your description of counterintelligence is very apt. Who's doing what to whom? The discipline of counterintelligence is you're trying to fight enemy spies. You're trying to basically get a handle on what they are doing. How many of them are there? How are they communicating? What do their networks look like? That's counterintelligence. And Elizabeth was doing counterintelligence at all stages of her career. In a lot of ways, she was a pioneer of counterintelligence. She was doing counterintelligence before America had official counterintelligence teams. She was doing it for the Treasury Department, doing counterintelligence against the rum runners. And then she was doing counterintelligence during World War II, you know, tracking the networks and throwing light on these dark networks of Nazi spies. And, you know, today, counterintelligence, as you said, involves the same kinds of principles, but examining different kinds of communication. So today it might be email, the Trump-Russia probe. These guys are looking at emails, and they're looking at trails of financial data and these sorts of things to try to understand the penetration of Russian spies into America and possible connections with the Trump campaign. Elizabeth was doing this kind of work using primarily the tool of radio. And anybody in the world who was communicating with radio and trying to keep it secret and was an enemy of the United States, Elizabeth was their nemesis, because over and over she was able to go in and do counterintelligence and succeed to map their networks and catch them and stop them.
My guest, Jason Fagone, author of The Woman Who Smashed Codes, The True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. You know, Jason, all her life, despite her accomplishments, she was shut out of the male-dominated Washington institutions. And after her husband, William, died in 1969, she literally received what was called a woman card from the all-male club to which her husband had belonged, which granted her access to the club for only a period of 2 years as a widow's privilege. Yeah, I mean, really, come on.
What an honor.
What an honor, I know. And, you know, the pioneer of modern counterintelligence and intelligence. You know, we cover a lot in these interviews, and we've created a terrific website to help you access them and to get more insight. To hear this again, to find out more about Jason and this book, don't forget to go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, and sign up for our weekly update or ask us a question. We'd love to get questions. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Great book. We'll put it on our recommended reading list.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.